Okay. Thank you very much for being here this evening, the last of our legal ethics classes for the year. I want to thank the Bayit and Shari Shamayim for partnering to promote this program along with my Beit Midrash. And Sergio and Jeffrey, I don't see Jeffrey on yet. Thank you for your help in preparing this session, which is on artificial intelligence and the practice of law. This session has been accredited by the Law Society of Ontario for 1.5 professionalism hours. As I think a lot of you know, certainly based on some of the notes that I got in the chat, thank you. God willing, I'll be moving to New York this summer. There is a plan to continue these classes. What exactly that's going to look like is unclear to me right now. But
that's wonderful.
Thank you, Michael. You're on the legal ethics email list, then you should get notification once we know what we're talking about. As I've been posting in the chat, I've been posting the link for the source sheet, but also in the event that you want a credit letter for participating, or if you're not on the email list for the class and you would like to be, please sign in the Zoom chat. Please note, we do not record video of the classes, so the only way that I can certify that you were here is if you write in your name in the chat. You can send it to me as a direct message instead of for everybody if you want. You do not need to include your email address unless you're not getting the emails yet, in which case, yes, I will need you to include your email address or I will not be able to send you a credit letter. If people are able to keep their screens on, that would be great. As I said, we're not recording video, so it doesn't matter if people are watching you eat dinner. We're all friends.
I don't know about that.
Oh, come on, Michael. People would pay to watch you eat dinner, Michael. Okay. So
I thought I was the comedian. That's pretty good.
This session is going to be a blend of technology, law, ethics. As always, I am not intending to present practical halachic advice for this is what you should do. You should ask your rabbi practical halachic questions. It is also not legal advice. I am not even a lawyer. With that all in mind, let's get started. First of all, if you look on your sheet, you see source number one, and I'll post the link once again in the chat for those who just joined. Source number one just tells you the professionalism topic that we are covering in this presentation is 3.17, technology in a law or legal services practice, including considerations related to security of information, productivity, and efficiency. I gave you a few links in source number two. The first one is a link for past legal ethics sessions so that if you want to catch any of the recordings of previous sessions, you can go there. And I haven't put there the links for this year's classes, but the ones from the last decade or so are all on there, as well as for three previous classes that I gave related to artificial intelligence, one in 2019, Must an Artificial Intelligence Observe Shabbos? Short answer is no, but there's more to say. Second, the ethics of robo-advising from 2021. That was oriented towards accountants, but a lot of it does relate to law. And artificial intelligence and medical decisions, which was in 2022 for the doctors. What's interesting to me in particular is that as I prepared this session, I looked back at what I had done in the previous ones, and so much is new in the field. Between the medical one that I did in 2022 and now, so much has evolved. And there's a lot, of course, also that's directly relevant for law that wasn't in those. So the introduction of functional artificial intelligence, and especially generative artificial intelligence, has taken the world by storm. And we're going to talk about what those terms mean and what they look like in practice in a moment, but I wanted to launch a poll. It is an anonymous poll, so don't be afraid. You can answer it and no one will know your answers. Two questions. Number one, have you used ChatGPT in your legal practice? I'm not asking if you are the lawyer in that Avianca Airlines case, which we're going to talk about. But have you used ChatGPT in your legal practice? Yes, no, or I am not a legal professional. And then the second question, have you used any other AI-driven tool in your legal practice? For example, LexisNexis offers AI-driven tools, as we're going to discuss. So have you done that? Yes, no, or I am not a legal professional. I was thinking about including one like, I don't know, maybe I did. But I didn't include that as a as an option. Use your judgment. So I'm just going to give it another couple of seconds for people to respond. We've already got about two-thirds of the people having responded. So that's good. Actually, question number one has about 70% response, and question number two has 100% response. Interesting. Okay. All right, we gave everybody a minute. I'm going to share the results. So on the first question of our 53 screens, have you used ChatGPT in your legal practice? We've got two-thirds saying no. We've got 18% saying yes. And then 16% who say, I'm not a legal professional, I don't know what you're talking about. And then for the second one, have you used any other AI-driven tool? So we've got 16% saying yes, we've got 68% saying no, and again, the same, you know, the same 16% of people saying, I am not a legal professional. So some number have used ChatGPT, and some more have used some other AI-driven tool in their practice. Of course, there could be overlap between the two. You can't add those two numbers and say 32% have used one. But this is just an interesting bit of information that it's clearly creeping into use, and it is going to become much, much bigger in the near future. The major flashpoint for the arrival of AI in the public mindset was the introduction of ChatGPT last November. But it's really been building for a long time, you know, as evidenced by the robo-advisors class that I gave back in 2021 to the accountants. We're going to talk a lot about how AI works and its uses in practicing law. But just briefly, here are some of the issues for which the law is trying to catch up. If you take a look on your sheet, source number 3, because I had to include this. I actually sent out the note about the class on May 27th, and half an hour later saw this article, "Here's what happens when your lawyer uses ChatGPT." From the New York Times. And then after that, I got it from I don't know how many people who sent it to me. The lawsuit began like so many others. A man named Roberto Mata sued the airline Avianca, saying he was injured when a metal serving cart struck his knee during a flight to Kennedy International Airport in New York. When Avianca asked a Manhattan federal judge to toss out the case, Mr. Mata's lawyers vehemently objected, submitting a 10-page brief that cited more than half a dozen relevant court decisions. There was Martinez versus Delta Airlines, Zicherman versus Korean Airlines, and of course, Varghese versus China Southern Airlines. With its learned discussion of federal law and, quote, the tolling effect of the automatic stay on a statute of limitations. There was just one hitch. No one, not the airline's lawyers, not even the judge himself, could find the decisions or the quotations cited and summarized in the brief. That was because ChatGPT had invented everything. The lawyer who created the brief, Stephen A. Schwartz, of the firm Levidov, Levidov and Obermann, threw himself on the mercy of the court on Thursday, saying in an affidavit that he had used the artificial intelligence program to do his legal research, a source that has revealed itself to be unreliable, end quote. Mr. Schwartz, who has practiced law in New York for 3 decades, what did he do before ChatGPT came along? I don't know. Told Judge P. Kevin Castle that he had no intent to deceive the court or the airline. Mr. Schwartz said that he had never used ChatGPT and, quote, therefore was unaware of the possibility that its content could be false. Should have asked his kids. He had, he told Judge Castle, even asked the program to verify that the cases were real. It had said yes. I love it. So we're going to have to talk about the product liability issue. What happens when you use AI and things don't go as you had hoped? That's going to be one of the cases that we're going to have to deal with. But seriously, fellow, I mean, come on.
Wow, I was aware that it could sometimes make mistakes, but that a wholesale amount.
Oh no, it makes things. Up. It's not called making things up in the AI field. It's called hallucinating. That's the term. It's called, I'm not kidding. That's actually true. It's called hallucinating.
How does this happen?
So we'll talk about how. I'm going to get to that a little bit later, or a lot later, but I do want to talk about why it spits this out. It's fascinating stuff. Other issues that come up, privacy issues regarding the data that they use for training the AI, intellectual property regarding the AI's use of someone else's creative work, as well as protection of the work that's generated by the AI. Discrimination. What happens if an insurance company uses AI to analyze the likelihood that people from particular races or lifestyles are going to develop an illness? Now what happens? So there's so much that's developing here. A lot really is in the liability department. Canada is working now on the AIDA Act, which stands for Artificial Intelligence and Data Act. It's part of the Digital Information and Privacy Act, C-27. And if you look on your sheet, it's source number 4. I gave you a brief description from the website that discusses it. And I'm going to just put the link in the chat again to the person who just messaged me. Yes, messaging me counts as signing in. Signing on to the Zoom does not. Signing in the chat does. The AIDA will introduce new requirements for businesses to ensure the safety and fairness of high-impact AI systems every step of the way. Design. Businesses will be required to identify and address the risks of their AI system with regard to harm and bias and to keep relevant records. Development. Businesses will be required to assess the intended uses and limitations of their AI system and make sure users understand them. Well, like that lawyer in the airlines case. Deployment. Businesses will be required to put in place appropriate risk mitigation strategies and ensure systems are continually monitored. We don't want the AI blowing up the world. We would like to avoid that if at all possible. Secondarily, we would like to avoid having the AI assist others in blowing up the world. That's also a problem. So some of those are considerations along the way. Yes, there's a lot more than that. But the AIDA really is focused on the problem of businesses creating or using an AI in an inappropriate way. So we're going to look at a range of cases. We only have 90 minutes for this, or now we're down to more like 75. So what we're going to do is see a range of cases, each one a little less deeply than I would like to, frankly, but I wanted to see a sense of the issues that are going to come up as you incorporate AI technology in your legal practice. So I've given you 5 vignettes. We're not going to get to all 5. I'm not even pretending we're going to get to number 5, but I had to include it because Sergio was so kind as to send me a lot of information on this. So it's on there and it's something that's worth thinking about. But we're going to get to the first 4 is my hope. Brief introduction, though, to AI and the practice of law. So very fast primer on artificial intelligence. I don't know what everybody knows, and I want to make sure that we all have certain basic information. So I'm going to define artificial intelligence in the following way. A computer program, software in other words, and or specialized device, which is capable of analyzing large troves of data, finding patterns, and making relevant predictions based on those patterns. So as an example, ChatGPT absorbs monstrous amounts of information, all sorts of documents, and based on those documents, it is able, in response to a prompt, to start spitting out an answer in which it predicts the likelihood of what the next word should be in the sentence that it is making. I could give you some great examples from stuff I've played around with, but I think we've reached a stage as a society in which most people have seen or used ChatGPT, and you don't really need me to provide that. If you haven't, though, you should definitely try it. I'll give you just one example that I'll mention without going into it. I was helping one of my kids with their U.S. tax filings. And there's a form that you file for a certain type of income. I forget what it was called. It was like 3586 or something like that. And I was a little bored. And so I asked ChatGPT to write a poem. No, to write a Dvar Torah, a Torah thought on form 3586 in verse. And it did so. And it wasn't bad. So it's worth playing around with. But there are two basic types of AI. One is analytic. And the other is generative. Analytic means it finds the patterns and it makes predictions, and we'll talk about applications of that in a moment. Generative is the cooler version of this. Having learned the data, it actually generates new data, whether that's text, audio, pictures, video, whatever it may be. Applications include, for the analytics side, diagnosing diseases by comparing symptoms with millions of electronic health records, identifying early signs of stroke from CAT scans. Those are analytic. On the generative side, drug discovery, analyzing compounds to determine their effectiveness and actually creating or suggesting new potential compounds. Interfacing with patients in order to take their information and ask them questions can be generative. In terms of the practice of law, so if you take a look on your sheet at source number 5, I gave you off of the LexisNexis website an article, The Power of Artificial Intelligence and Legal Research. This is an example of two services that they are currently offering. This is not an advertisement for LexisNexis, to be clear. One is called Brief Analysis. Brief Analysis mines archives of legal precedents to find supporting documentation that bolsters your legal argument. The more it's used, the more it automatically learns and gets smarter, which makes it faster and easier to find and digest relevant documents. So this is not generative. It's not creating anything. It's identifying resources that you're able to use. Context is an AI-backed judicial analytics tool sold separately from LexisPlus that analyzes a judge's past decisions, enabling lawyers to pinpoint the types of arguments a certain judge typically finds most persuasive. With access to not only ruling history, but also the specific type of language a judge uses in court, you can garner insights that make or break a case. How do you like that? Isn't that neat? Who needs law school anymore? This is on the analytics side. There are AI that search through existing contracts to make sure a new contract is going to be consistent with the old ones. There's lots of stuff out there. Generative AI. This is a lot of fun. Take a look at source number 6. Believe it or not, this article is from January 2017. Okay, so this is describing a technology that's actually, apparently, been around for 6 years. It was the first day of school for Dan Lear's 3 kids. In a scramble to get his boys to class on time, the Seattle lawyer wound up parking in a space he probably should have avoided. Quote, there was a fire hydrant, but the curb wasn't painted. The fire hydrant was painted a kind of funny color. And so I thought maybe it was wishful thinking, but I thought it would be okay to park there, he says. Sure enough, Lear returned to a ticket. I was bummed. I mean, obviously no one's really happy when they get a ticket, but I went home, I put it on my fridge and let it sit there because I just didn't want to deal with it, he says. So he found something that would. Do Not Pay, a free online robot lawyer. It has helped drivers in London and New York City appeal parking tickets. It had just expanded into Seattle and Lear decided to give it a go. He logged in, and the Do Not Pay bot asked Lear a series of questions, like where the ticket was issued, a description of what happened. Within minutes, he had a 500-word letter to send to the city. The verdict? Ultimately, yeah, they let me off, Lear says. The idea behind Do Not Pay belongs to Joshua Browder, a 20-year-old student at Stanford University who is originally from London. I love it. The 20-year-old came up with this. Isn't that great? But this is generative AI from 2017. Another example of this. This is a fantastic article. In number 7, you should read this article. It's really a remarkable read from the Lewis and Clark Law Review, Legal Liability for Artificially Intelligent Robot Lawyers. Today's robot lawyers are no longer just classroom experiments that dabble in issue spotting or legal research. Attorneys use robot lawyers to perform substantive legal work and dispense real legal advice. For example, Kira Systems sells a robot lawyer to law firms that scans a client's previous contracts, identifies important terms within the contracts, and generates a personalized draft for attorney review within seconds. Legalmation, another startup, promises attorneys that a robot lawyer will automatically draft, quote, responsive pleadings, discovery requests and responses, and related documents that are tailored to the claims, allegations, and requests in the legal document uploaded, incorporating jurisdictional requirements as well as the attorney's own style, formatting, and response strategy. These non-autonomous robot lawyers, which are controlled by human attorneys, benefit the legal profession by increasing profit margins, reducing mundane work, and expanding access to justice. One wonders what articling students are going to do in the future. Okay, so this is these are some examples of AI's use in the practice of law. I've been just talking a lot. So I'm going to pause here for comments and questions before we get to some of our cases and the issues that this raises, both from a Jewish ethics standpoint as well as from a general ethics standpoint. Yes. Nope, we're good. Okay, then let's go. Yeah, Michael, you were going to say?
Not me.
Oh, okay. You unmuted. Okay, then let's start. Take a look at the first vignette, going back to the first side of the source sheet. Bina and Da'at, LLP, is a century-old law firm specializing in corporate law. Yes, the words Bina and Da'at are Hebrew terms for different kinds of intelligence. Intelligence or knowledge. Bina and Da'at is a century-old law firm specializing in corporate law. After researching new artificial intelligence research tools, they want to bring on board Chochma, AI-powered legal research software designed to scan databases, investigate relevant laws and precedents, and produce accurate, succinct results. Are they obligated to notify clients that they are implementing this new tool? Is there any reason why they have to tell the client that they are doing this? What would you say?
This is not responsible for any errors they're going to make. I mean, it's like anything else.
Yeah.
If it turns out not to go well for them, they're going to be on the hook. But they don't. I don't know why they don't have to disclose everything to the client that they're doing. I mean,
right.
If you want your client using AI, you don't want to use AI. If your client uses AI, what do they need you for?
They can go to Do Not Pay.
Rabbi,
yes. Anybody think that there's a requirement to notify the client? Yeah, Jerry, you think there is? Yeah, you're muted.
I think there's absolutely a requirement to notify the client, especially at this stage where AI is a relatively new tool that's being used. And especially where we're finding that these systems are capable of hallucinating very easily,
yeah,
and producing large amounts of information, returning large amounts of information and results, which are frankly incorrect or untruthful or non-existent. Mm-hmm. So I think we absolutely, and certainly at this stage, have a requirement to do so. I compare it to the disclaimer that's put at the bottom of lawyer signatures and email messages where they talk about confidentiality and solicitor-client privileges and so on. I've seen over the years that less and less lawyers are now including this statement in their messages because it's become an accepted part of the practice of law that people now are generally assumed to know that this is the case.
Interesting. Okay. I'm not so sure that that's true based on the things I've seen forwarded, but okay. Shira, you were going to say?
Yeah. I'm assuming that the AI-generated document, whatever it might be, is going to be reviewed by the senior lawyer in charge who has the liability for what happens. And I'm not sure if in that case, assuming that happens, there's any more requirement to say, who did the draft than if a junior lawyer or articling student or even a clerk, whoever does your drafting before it gets to the senior person.
Right.
To tell them that. I'm not sure that you don't have to tell your client who did the preliminary draft of the pleading. That again supposes that the person ultimately responsible, senior counsel ultimately responsible, has, you know, got over it and rejected.
Right. So I tend to agree for the most part with what Michael and Shira said, with a caveat regarding what Jerry said. In general, in the practice of law, transparency with the client is not required. The practice of law is not like the practice of medicine, where there's a concept of informed consent. There is no requirement that I can find that the client know how you are doing your job, only that you provide satisfactory services. You have two entities that have to be satisfied, right? The client has to be satisfied, and the law society has to be satisfied. And the law society's rules aren't about transparency. They're about quality of service. If you take a look at source number 8, I brought you from the Rules of Professional Conduct. In this rule, this is from 3.1-1, 3.1-2, about quality of service. In this rule, competent lawyer means a lawyer who has and applies relevant knowledge, skills, and attributes in a manner appropriate to each matter undertaken on behalf of a client. A lawyer shall perform any legal services undertaken on a client's behalf to the standard of a competent lawyer. Why do we require that as our standard? In order to satisfy a whole bunch of people. From the commentary, number 14. A lawyer who is competent does the who is incompetent does the client a disservice, brings discredit to the profession, and may bring the administration of justice into disrepute. In addition to damaging the lawyer's own reputation and practice, incompetence may also injure the lawyer's partners and associates. So those are bad things that we want to avoid. However, that doesn't mean the lawyer has to be perfect. As you see in the commentary number 15, this rule does not require a standard of perfection. An error or omission, even though it might be actionable for damages in negligence or contract, will not necessarily constitute a failure to maintain the standard of professional competence described in the rule. While damages may be awarded for negligence, incompetence can give rise to the additional sanction of disciplinary action. Incompetence is a lot worse than negligence is, and the results of it are potentially worse. But your obligation fundamentally is to serve the client in a way that is competent. And it goes on to talk about failure to meet the standards of professional competence includes deficiency in the lawyer's knowledge, skill, or judgment, attention to the interests of clients, the record, systems, or procedures, other aspects of the lawyer's professional business. Those are ways in which a lawyer may be found to be incompetent. I also noted for you in number 9 from Rule 3.2-1, a lawyer has a duty to provide courteous, thorough, and prompt service to clients. Those are the requirements. It has to be timely, conscientious, and so on, none of which is violated by use of the AI. I just need to know what I'm doing with the AI and to operate it to the standard of a competent lawyer, and the client need not know anything. From the standpoint of Jewish law, because we're now 30 minutes in or 29 minutes in, it's about time that we reach something Jewish, the halachic system is similar. Your client has a right to a level of service, but not to dictate how you provide that service. The Jewish lawyer has a duty socially and religiously to work hard. That's our obligation. If you take a look at source number 10, a classic passage from the Gemara in Bava Metzia, and I'll read out my English translation. A shepherd was herding animals on the bridge of the Papa River. One slipped and fell into the water. He came before Rabba, who said he was not liable. The shepherd is not liable, saying, what should he have done? He guarded as people normally do. Your job is to be a competent shepherd. Abaye replied, then had he gone into the city at a time when people normally do, would he have been exempt from liability if he had left the sheep? The answer is yes. Had he slept a bit at a time when people normally sleep, would he also have been exempt? Yes. Abaye challenged this and said, I have a source that says the following. Referencing a story from the book of Genesis of Bereshit, in which Jacob is guarding the sheep of his father-in-law, Lavan, Jacob says, I was consumed by withering heat during the day and frost at night. And the Talmud says, that's how far a paid guardian has to go in doing the job. So it says you have to put up with withering heat, you have to put up with frost at night. It doesn't sound like you get to leave as people normally do. To which Rabba replied, that's specifically a municipal guard. That's not something that an individual normally has to do. That's unique to somebody with a higher degree of responsibility. To which Abaye asked, was Jacob a municipal guard? He's just watching the sheep of his father-in-law. To which the response was, yeah, but he had promised a higher level of service. This is what we hold in practice. The responsibility of a person who is hired to do a job is to do the job at a competent level. So if you take a look at source number 11, the Rambam, Maimonides, brings this as law. He says, just as an employer is warned not to steal the pay of a pauper, not to delay it, so the pauper is warned not to steal the work of the employer, wasting a little here and a little there and so spending the entire day cleverly. Rather, he must be precise with his time, for the sages were even careful not to recite the fourth blessing of the blessing after meals on an employer's time, right? There are four core blessings in the blessing after meals, and the rule was that somebody being paid by the hour is not allowed to recite the fourth blessing, which is rabbinic, as opposed to the other three, because you have a responsibility to get back to work. That's not generally held today, because today employers are required to give you break times. But this is talking about a society in which break times did not exist. And so Maimonides continues to say he must also work with all of his energy, for the righteous Jacob said, I worked for your father with all of my energy. Therefore, Jacob was rewarded even in this world, as it says, and the man became very, very great. So Jacob was rewarded because he worked really, really hard. So one source that teaches me that there is a duty to work in a competent way and with integrity is Jacob. Another source for it is source number 12. The Torah says that an employer is required to pay on time. In the event that you're paying somebody for working for you by the hour during the day, so you have one pay period, so to speak, to pay them. So you have to pay them by the end of the night. You're not allowed to delay. That's a basic rule. And the Torah says that the reason why this is so important is because this person who works for you put his life on the line in working for you. And there, the Medrash comments in source number 12, from the fact that the Torah describes him as risking his life, that tells you that that's the level that is actually expected of an employee, is to work that hard. That's the basic rule. So that if somebody is negligent in his work, that can actually be grounds for termination. But once again, the definition of the quality of work that we expect from you is governed by local standard, whatever people normally do. So if you take a look at source number 13 from the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, the hours for which one works are set by the local norm. In a place where the practice is not to rise early and stay late, one who hires employees and tells them to rise early and stay late cannot coerce them, even based on higher wages, because he didn't stipulate it when hiring them. You have to tell them when you hire them that you want them to keep those hours. Otherwise, you can't say to them, that was what I expected. So the answer so far is, as long as you're dealing with it at a competent level, even though, as Jerry pointed out, it's a new technology, you're not obligated to notify them. However, and here I come back to the question of how the AI makes mistakes. There is an issue called automation bias or automation complacency. And this is something that you see in other areas of technology. It's not only about AI. This is a general technology issue. It's when somebody says, you know, if the machine does it, it must be good. The assumption that the technology is, by dint of being technology, is for sure going to do it right. And the reality is that that's not the case, certainly with AI, because as we noted, among other things, you have the hallucination problem. And here I'll explain one of the reasons why you get wrong answers from an AI. Here I'm also going to note, if anybody didn't yet sign in the chat and you want a credit letter, I do need you to actually put your name in the chat. You can direct message it to me and that's fine. So one of the issues with AI is that it isn't able to say, I don't know. Unless it's not supposed to know. Like if you ask ChatGPT about something from 2023, it will tell you, I'm only trained on data through 2021. But otherwise, it doesn't say, I don't know. Rather,
it's a meaning. I mean, I've had a couple of times where it says, you know, this is not something that, the information that I can get.
Right. No, that's true. Where it's not within its parameters, like the data that's after 2021, then it can say, I don't know. But if it's supposed to know, then what it does is it gives you the best odds answer that it's able to generate. And the best odds might be 10% likelihood of being right, but that's what it's going to give you. It's only where it's... It's not fabricating. It's giving you something that's extremely unlikely, but it's the best answer it had. I'll give you, take a look at number 14. This is an article from the Journal of Academic Medicine regarding Watson, the IBM computer that played Jeopardy. By the end of its three-game Jeopardy run, Watson had defeated its human competitors by a considerable margin. While the result was impressive, Watson's most memorable moment for some came during the final round, when it responded Toronto to a question about American cities. Now, there is a Toronto in the United States. Not only that, there are people from places like Calgary who consider Toronto to be an American city. So at some point, it hoovered up information which included something about a Toronto in the United States. In this instance, Watson's probabilistic answering design prevented it from excluding any solutions with total certainty, leading to an incorrect, albeit low confidence, conclusion that the audience knew was obviously incorrect. That's an example of how an AI makes a mistake. Another example is when it picks up on the wrong information. This is called Clever Hans. This is fascinating. Take a look at number 15. From the development point of view, explainability, when you could actually understand the machine's answer because it explains how it got there, will regularly be helpful for developers to sanity check their AI models beyond mere performance. For example, it is highly beneficial to rule out that the prediction performance is based on metadata rather than the data itself. What do you mean? Take a look at this example and you'll understand. A famous non-medical example was the classification task to discern between huskies and wolves. It's shown a whole bunch of pictures. Tell us which ones have huskies and which ones have wolves. That's the assignment. The prediction was solely drawn by the identification of a snowy background rather than real differences between huskies and wolves. Because what happened was, it saw the pictures, it had the answer key to be able to know these are huskies and these are wolves. It recognized that when at certain backgrounds it tends to be a husky, certain backgrounds it tends to be a wolf. And that was how it then made its analysis. This phenomenon is also called a Clever Hans phenomenon, and it's also found in medicine. And they give you this great story in which they used a machine at Mount Sinai Hospital, I don't know which one, to try to distinguish high-risk patients from non-high-risk patients based on their x-rays. It did a great job. However, they used it outside of Mount Sinai Hospital, and it was terrible because it wasn't doing it based on the x-ray. It was doing it based on the metadata attached to the x-ray, which was the set of codes that were on it that showed which department the x-rays came from. So as long as it was in Mount Sinai Hospital, it figured out which x-rays actually were coming from high-risk sources and which ones were not. But try that elsewhere, and your system completely falls apart, and it doesn't know what it's doing. So machines can make mistakes for a whole host of reasons, and the bottom line and the fear is that people become complacent. They assume the machine knows what it's doing, and that's an article that I brought from the British Medical Journal in source number 16. This is a concern. So you don't have to warn the client, but you better make sure that you know what you're doing with this. That was case number one. Clear?
What about the complete fabrication? You're mentioning them in this hallucination.
Yeah.
Where they completely and totally fabricated case law
right.
and decisions. Like
right. So what it's doing is it's actually gauging what the answer should be. It's betting on what the next word should be based on data that it has already absorbed in its training set. So it's trying to figure out what the next answer should be. I'll give you an example. The first time I saw a ChatGPT product, someone sent me a responsum it had written. Somebody asked ChatGPT to write a rabbinic responsum regarding the kosher status of animals found on Mars. And it gave a responsum. And it quoted the Talmud in Chulin on page 7a, and it quoted the Talmud in Chulin on page whatever it was, and it gave a very interesting and cogent argument. But I read it and said, those aren't passages in the Talmud. And, of course, I looked up the pages to, like, make sure that I wasn't, you know, just wrong. And there's nothing there like that. But it knows what a rabbinic responsum sounds like. And it knows the type of argumentation. And it even knows that if there was going to be rabbinic material about the kashrut of a creature, it was probably going to be in the volume called Chulin. It's pretty clever.
The source that it quoted and the language that it was actually existent?
No, it made it up.
But it made it up.
It made it up because it knew what the answer should sound like.
Oh.
Yeah. Awesome.
I think I may go in with Jerry here and say, I don't know. I mean, you certainly shouldn't.
You have to be smart about what you do.
But this seems like a very dangerous program.
Yes, absolutely. And a lot of fun at the same time. But yes, it definitely fits in the dangerous category as well. So that's case number one. Case number two. Go back to the first side, please. Actually, the top of the second side. This one is a fairly clear-cut case, but I wanted to include it because it is an issue that's come up. Bina and Da'at LLP is approached by Chochma's developers. Chochma is the AI that they're using. They're training a next-generation AI and want to use the data from Bina and Da'at's extensive archives. You have a century of cases. We want to process those. In exchange, they will give Bina and Da'at LLP free access to Chochma 2.0. Are there ways for Bina and Da'at to accommodate this request? What would you say? Is there any way they can allow that?
If you don't use the actual names, I suppose, of the parties or something like that.
So even if you remove the names, I would strongly recommend against doing that, because you don't need names to figure things out. I brought you an article on the sheet in source number 17. I am not going to read it aloud. It's very long. But the article is Riding with the Stars, Passenger Privacy in the New York City Taxi Cab Dataset. From 2014, there was, as you see in the beginning of the article, a dataset released by the New York City Taxi and Limousine Commission with details about every taxi ride in New York in 2013. Pickup and drop-off times, locations, fare and tip amounts, anonymized versions of the taxi's license, and medallion numbers. It was released as part of the Freedom of Information Law because somebody requested it. Well, this fellow managed to use it in order to figure out who it was who was frequenting certain institutions where people would not generally want to be known to be frequenting. He was able to use it to pinpoint locations where they were frequently dropped off, and then using, as you see in the article towards the end of it, using Facebook, using other websites, they were able to figure out the property value, the ethnicity, the relationship status, five likely drop-off addresses. You can see it there. This guy was able to do the analysis and figure it out. And the article itself is entertaining. But the point here is that you can't assume anonymizing data is going to work, because often that which is anonymized can also be exposed. So you could turn to an AI and say to it, can you figure out who this is? And the AI can be your private detective and using public information tell you exactly who it is. So in the secular system, we have two issues. Number one, I'm going to hopefully pronounce it correctly, PIPEDA, is that how it's pronounced? PIPEDA legislation limits commercial use of personal data. So I gave you one case in number 18 about physicians disclosing about the disclosure of information on physicians' prescribing patterns. That was the issue there. You can't do that because there was information involved that should not be. There it was okay, because it wasn't information about the doctor and the patient. Sorry, there it actually was all right for them to do it. But generally speaking, if there's any information, even not identifying information, that's no good. That's number one. And number two, specific to the practice of law, if you look at number 19, a lawyer at all times should hold in strict confidence all information concerning the business and affairs of the client acquired in the course of the professional relationship and shall not divulge any such information unless expressly or impliedly authorized by the client or required by law, required to provide the information to the law society, and so on. But otherwise, you are not able to do so because doing so would be very detrimental to the client as well as to the practice of law overall because clients aren't going to trust their lawyers. So from a law society perspective, no, you can't buy the rights to Chochma 2.0 by giving the AI company your archive of data. From a Jewish law perspective, also definitely not a good thing. Jewish law is very strict in being in favor of privacy with an expectation of privacy as the norm. And the arguments include source number 20, where the Talmud teaches, how do we know that one may not repeat that which he is told until he is told, go tell it. Someone gives you a piece of information. Even if they don't say to you, this is a secret, you're not allowed to share it with others. To do so is called in Hebrew, rechilus. You're not allowed to tell other people until the person says to you, go tell it. How do I know? Because when God speaks to Moshe, to Moses, he has to say to him, go tell the Jews X. Until God says, go tell, Moshe is not allowed to tell. You're not allowed to communicate another person's private information. That's number one. Number two, if you do convey somebody's information in a way that they don't want, you could actually be held liable. If you take a look at source number 21 from Maimonides, statements which, if publicized, would cause financial harm, physical harm, or even pain or fear, just emotional distress, are all called lashon hara and therefore prohibited. One may not live in such people's neighborhoods, let alone sit with them and listen to them. You can't have anything to do with somebody who will cause people a loss or even emotional distress with their speech. It is prohibited to investigate somebody else's personal activities. So I brought you a Mishnah in source number 22, talking about zoning issues. One may not open a window opposite somebody else's window, meaning not open like you open and close your window, but create a window in your property opposite someone else's window, or a door opposite a door across a yard owned in partnership. One may not increase the size of your door or window, or turn one into two. However, if it's into a public domain, that's a different story. So this one is also relatively clear. This is an issue of privacy. This is going to be a major issue, not only in terms of the obvious case that we just mentioned, but when deploying AI in order to research a litigant in a case, the stuff that your AI is going to pull may not be stuff you're entitled to. This is going to be it's going to require some legislation to deal with that.
Yeah. If I can ask a question right here, because I think it's pertinent to the discussion. So, if you cannot investigate, how are you supposed to do your work?
Mm-hmm.
You understand? Part of the lawyer's duties is to get to the bottom. So those, I don't practice litigation, but those who do litigation, commercial litigation, for example, many times they hire private investigators to research and dig up the dirt on the other party, right?
Right. So the ethics of private investigating are fascinating, both on the secular side and on the religious side. Meaning, whatever you're doing in investigating the affairs of your own client, your client has agreed to. That's why they hired you. However, the opposing litigant did not hire you. And it's true. You'd have to be extremely careful about what you look into and what you do with the information you find. It's not simple and straightforward. It's very true.
Right, but in the same vein, like, for example, when you're using this artificial intelligence tool, you may
accidentally that is really useful to you.
Right.
So.
You may, and it's a problem.
You cannot use it.
So my argument would be that there may well be stuff that turns up that you're not allowed to use. In the same way that if someone's emails are hacked and released online, I'm not allowed to read that. The fact that it's now accessible to the world does not license me to do so. Somebody.
No, that's information that's released to the public. I mean, it's causing additional damage. You know, there's the Privacy Act, the Privacy Act Canada, or whatever it's called, I forget now. And if I'm not mistaken, the banks rely on this very heavily not to give you any information. I was going to ask, does that depend at what stage you're at? If you've got a judgment debtor, in other words, you're at the stage already where you've already gotten your judgment, one of the biggest problems that, representatives, lawyers and paralegals have when they try to help their clients is enforcing the judgment, which the courts help you not at all. But according to the Privacy Act, you are allowed to release information in the aid of enforcement of the judgment. But the banks just say, hey, not my problem. Sorry, my internal policy is...
Right, so what are you asking me?
So I'm saying from a total point of view, as well as from maybe a secular point of view, if it's already past the... let's say you've got a boom total where somebody is... has been found to owe to the other party, you should be able to...
Yeah. No,
people that you approach should be able to release information to you that would be helpful to your client or your...
Yeah, no, anything that the client, not the client, the opposing, client, as the case may be, but anything that they have agreed to, there's been a judgment on a bankruptcy case, they're now required to uphold and to help with. So yes, for that piece of it, I do agree. So, the third case is where things get more complicated. Cases one and two were softballs, right? The understanding that you don't have a requirement to tell them as long as you're competent that you're using it, and the idea that you can't disclose the data to use it for training in AI is, I think, relatively straightforward. But now we come to case number three. The lawyers of a small firm, Pachim Ketanim LLP, try to build their reputation by publishing articles on the practice of law. They start asking ChatGPT to generate articles based on the work of others. Okay, so based on the writings of so-and-so, the lawyer, Sergio Caris's writings in the Law Times or whatever it is, generate something in his style. That seems to go well. Until they are threatened with a suit by a law library for plagiarizing their intellectual property. Is Pachim Ketanim LLP in the wrong? Are they not allowed to ask ChatGPT to produce something in the style of so-and-so who has written a whole bunch of articles? What would you say?
Well, I would say they're not allowed. Because when they are asking ChatGPT to write in the style of that particular author, part and parcel of the way that author writes.
Yeah.
And that's part of the personality of that author.
Okay. So what's wrong? What have they done wrong?
What they've done wrong is they're basically imitating.
What's wrong with imitating? It's the sincerest form of flattery.
Some people don't want to be flattered.
Yes, Tilda.
I
wanted to hear what Tilda was going to say. Yeah.
Are the lawyers looking to, are they looking to sell it? I wasn't clear about what their intention was.
Right. So they are publishing the articles in order to build their reputation. I didn't specify whether they're being paid for the articles or not. You can play it either way.
So the reason I ask is a lot of lawyers, when you look at their websites, publish articles that they find from other places in order to bolster or give their clients knowledge. They're
right.
Not the authors of those articles, but I'm not sure I would object to that, but I guess the issue is if you're taking someone else's work product and you're looking to make a profit out of it, wouldn't that be considered? considered to be, you know, something that I think would cross the line into, you know, into an intellectual property take.
Right.
It's not the profit, though, that seems to be the issue here, whether it's a profit or not. It's the question of the actual contents. Are they imitating the work of the other person, of whomever?
Aren't they giving those people credit?
No.
They're not giving credit.
No, nope, they're not giving credit.
That's the problem. That's part of the problem.
No credit.
Isn't the devil in the details here, though?
Yeah.
I think if they're not giving them credit, that's an issue.
Okay, Michael.
If they're giving them credit and simply sort of creating a link for their clients to review it, I don't see there being an issue there.
Right. Michael, what were you going to say?
I think the devil's in the details. No, I mean, they're, it says that they're imitating the style. Style, you know, I mean, your style can be very vague. You know, the people don't have a right to, you know, a certain style.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody else can be prevented from using it. If they're really, I think that intellectual property law would not would be very sparing in recognizing a style. It would have to be something very, very specific.
Yes.
Really, I think you have to plagiarize. You have to plagiarize things and which are totally characteristic to that author before there would be any intellectual property. Violating.
Right. So we're going to get to that. If you would jump down at 25, you'll see a discussion about copywriting style. I'm going to get to a couple of other things first. So the first thing I want to mention is that this is already being litigated. This is I see your note, Greg. Take a look at number 23, please. From Kyle Wiggers from TechCrunch. The current legal cases against generative AI are just the beginning. This is from January. Microsoft, GitHub, and OpenAI are currently being sued in a class action motion that accuses them of violating copyright law by allowing Copilot, a code-generating AI system, it generates programming, trained on billions of lines of public code, to regurgitate licensed code snippets without providing credit. In other words, it's read through a lot of open source from various programs. It's going to borrow their, not borrow, it's going to take the techniques that are already in use. It is not going to give credit to the original programming. That's what this is going to do. So they're being sued. Two companies behind popular AI art tools, Midjourney and Stability AI, are in the crosshairs of a legal case that alleges they infringed on the rights of millions of artists by training their tools on web-scraped images. If you haven't done this yet, you have websites where you can go to, let's say one is called Crayon, C-R-A-I-Y-O-N, just a little on the nose, and you could ask it to, you know, draw you a picture of, I don't know, 63 people in a Zoom call talking about legal ethics, and it will, you know, generate pictures. You could ask it all sorts of funny things. You could ask it to give you a picture of Michael Lebovic riding a bicycle while wearing a clown nose, and it will do that. It'll give you four different versions. So the point is that these AIs are trained on other people's pictures, and elements of those pictures can make it into the results, like the note that somebody just put in the chat about asking an AI to write a story in the style of Hemingway or Faulkner. They couldn't handle Faulkner's style at all, which is interesting. They're getting sued for this. Just last week, stock image supplier Getty Images took Stability AI to court for reportedly using millions of images from its site without permission to train Stable Diffusion in art-generating AI. At issue mainly is generative AI's tendency to replicate images, text, and more, including copyrighted content, from the data that was used to train it. In a recent example, an AI tool used by CNET to write explanatory articles was found to have plagiarized articles written by humans, articles presumably swept up in its training dataset. Meanwhile, an academic study published in December found that image-generating AI models like DALL-E 2 and Stable Diffusion can and do replicate aspects of images from their training data. So this is very much being litigated. I saw Greg's note in the chat with the Andy Warhol case, which is a little separate, but involving elements of the intellectual property questions that we're dealing with. So you can make the argument that this is not a problem, that there's no violation going on. In terms of the training of the AI, take a look at source 24. This is from Canada's Copyright Act regarding fair dealing, section 29. Fair dealing for the purpose of research, private study, education, parody, or satire does not infringe copyright. So this is education. Your machine is learning, goes the argument. Now, as far as the product, the articles that I have found, the more coherent and clear articles, deal with U.S. copyright law or U.S. intellectual property law rather than Canadian. So they use terms like fair use instead of fair dealing. I'm not enough of an expert to be able to say where there are differences between U.S. and Canadian policies, but if someone can point something out that's different, I welcome it. But the articles say, first of all, and this was noted before, you can't really copyright a style. Source number 25, first AI art generator lawsuits threaten future of emerging tech from January 2023. In the complaint, the artists allege that AI tools permit users to create works, quote, in the style of a given artist, instead of commissioning or licensing an original work, violating the rights of millions of artists and resulting in works that compete with the originals. Style has proven difficult, if not impossible, to protect with copyright, some attorneys say. Style is an idea. Style is a technique. It's a process, said University of Kentucky law professor Michael Murray. These are things that are not protected by copyright. So one argument is, it's only a style and you can't copyright style. It actually goes on to say, my staple is on the word. Given an AI generator's ability to draw directly from the works of art it's trained on, however, there are circumstances in which, quote, the line between emulating style and wrongful copying is not always apparent, said Columbia law professor Jane Ginsburg. So there may be some cases that are difficult, but basically you can't copyright a style. That's number one. Argument number two is that the output of the AI is transformative, not derivative. So take a look at number 26 from that same article that I just quoted. The success of a fair use defense will depend on whether the works generated by the AI are considered transformative, whether they use the copyrighted works in a way that significantly varies from the originals. The minute you're able to make a work that's transformative, you removed it from the ambit of this idea that it's a mere derivative of the original work, said Vivek Jayaram, founder of Jayaram Law. Jayaram said, sorry? Was that to me? Jayaram said that previous case law, particularly the Supreme Court's 2021 Google versus Oracle decision, suggests that using collected data to create new works can be transformative. In that case, Google's use of portions of Java SE code to create its Android operating system was found to be fair use. Using IP or that training data to allow others to use the tool to create new work, that construct in and of itself, I don't think will be found to be completely infringing. That's the argument, is you're changing it, and therefore it's okay. And that's the argument that OpenAI, which is the company that made ChatGPT, that's their argument. I brought it in number 27 from their comments to the U.S. Patent Office. Training of AI systems is clearly highly transformative. Works in training corpora were meant primarily for human consumption for their standalone entertainment value. The object of the original creation, in other words, is direct human consumption of the author's expression. Intermediate copying of works in training AI systems is, by contrast, non-expressive. The copying helps computer programs learn the patterns inherent in human-generated media. The aim of this process, creation of a useful generative AI system, is quite different than the original object of human consumption. You follow what they're saying? Since the artist or the writer produced the intellectual property for humans, and they are now taking it and using it not for humans, but rather to train a machine, Therefore, they have transformed it. That's the OpenAI argument.
It's a step before the machine is going to be used by humans. No, I mean it's
a fascinating argument. I don't buy it, but it's a fascinating argument.
But you know, the copyright law has always. I'm sorry, I have some experience in this area.
Yes, go for it.
So I have to say that my tools are quite rusty because I haven't practiced in the area intensely within the last few years. But copyright law is always being focused on the expression of the work.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know, you always want to try to find whether there's an original expression of the work. I mean, in order that you can be sure that work is not a derivative work. But with AI, this brings us to a huge problem because you then get into the question of ownership of the work. Who owns the work? I mean, if all of these sources are being scraped together to put together this work, who ends up being the owner? I mean, we have similar situations with music where there, you know, for example, now particularly with current music, where there are beats or riffs,
yep.
Whatever, that are contributed by other artists in a single work. But copyright is able to have a way to compensate various creators. But if you're going to have works produced by millions and millions of different people, which culminate in a work produced by an AI program, then the whole question of ownership becomes extremely complicated.
It does. It does. One of the things that makes this challenging is when the AI produces something that looks like it's just ripped off from one work, but the argument is it's not. It actually is the amalgam of all the different data that it you know, drew on. But they're making the argument so far that, first of all, the training data is not an issue because it's for education. And the product that they generate, number one, you can't copyright your style. And number two, they've transformed whatever the data is that they took in. There is one other argument that they bring in this regard, that what they're producing is information about the work and not the actual work. It's a very interesting argument. If you take a look at source number 28, the first AI art generator lawsuits article, Matthew Sag, a law professor at Emory University focused on AI, said that AI training could be considered fair use under a 2015 Second Circuit case that the Supreme Court declined to review. The case there was about Google Books and its production of snippets of material from books. So the decision in Authors Guild versus Google found that digitizing books and displaying snippets of them without permission to allow text searching is transformative fair use. In that context, the fair use was clear, Sag said, because none of the original expression leaks out in the end. You're not really reading the book when you read three sentences from page 206. That's their argument, found also in the comment by OpenAI in number in source 29, but I'm not going to read it aloud. You can see it there. In general, there's one more argument to be made to say that there's no problem, and that is the matter of public policy. You don't want to use intellectual property law to squelch the production of creative intellectual property. If you take a look at source number 30, from the U.S. Congressional Research Service, Generative AI and Copyright Law. So number 29. The fair use doctrine permits courts, this is OpenAI's comment, permits courts to avoid rigid application of the copyright statute when on occasion it would stifle the very creativity which that law is designed to foster. The whole point, not the whole point, but one of the major points of copyright legislation, intellectual property legislation, is to encourage people to produce and to be creative. You're now going to use it to stifle creativity. So that's another argument, an overall argument. By the way, we're not discussing at all the other side of this, which is what is the status of intellectual property generated by the AI? Can somebody rip that off and say, well, it wasn't from a human and therefore they don't have a creator's protections? Or should the owner of the AI or the AI itself be viewed as the creator and hold the rights? I'm not even going there.
But I mean, you then approach the whole issue of whether you're going to give the so-called creator, sentient being, writes in this work.
So that's coming in vignette number 4. Just wait. That's going to be part of that discussion. The flip side of this, right, we've given the reasons why it's not a problem. But the flip side argues, first of all, when you train the AI, you are creating a copy of the original work by putting it into the database. You are already infringing the rights of the creator. That was the article number 30 from the Congressional Research Service. AI systems are trained to create literary, visual, and other artistic works by exposing the program to large amounts of data, which may consist of existing works such as text and images from the internet. This training process may involve making digital copies of existing works, carrying a risk of copyright infringement. It's part of the training process that this is already happening, and so that's a problem. Further, when it generates its product, the argument goes, and we've already seen it made, its product is derivative rather than transformative, right? That's the other argument. It's not transformative. Plus, and this takes us to the issue of music, you have another problem in terms of the way that this works. And this is, if you take a look at source number 31, somebody produced, and this is all over, if you go to YouTube, you can find lots of AI-generated music, but there was one song apparently made this very, very big deal. It was called Heart on My Sleeve, and it was supposed to be a song in the style of Drake and The Weeknd. For anyone who's a fan of either of those, fine. But it was supposed to be a song in the style of Drake and The Weeknd. It actually ended up being pulled down because the person who posted it made the mistake of including a few bars that were a straight-out lift, as opposed to what the AI produced, and therefore it could be pulled because of those few bars. But it was only pulled after millions and millions of people had listened to it. So here's a concern. Take a look at source number 31. Drake's AI clone is here, and Drake might not be able to stop him from May 1st. What if AI-generated unreleased Drake tracks surfaced and diverted revenue from actual Drake? What if the AI songs are just bad and people were convinced Drake lost his magic touch for hits? What if a creator made AI Drake sing a white nationalist anthem? The problem quickly expands beyond the scope of copyright and into Drake's personhood and identity. And unlike the wave of unknowns with AI, there is some precedent with how a person's likeness is used. And this is true within Canada's Copyright Act. Go to source number 32, where we talk about infringement in terms of creating take a look. It is not an infringement of copyright for an individual to use an existing work or other subject matter or copy of one, which has been published or otherwise made available to the public in the creation of a new work, other subject matter in which copyright subsists, and for the individual, it's not a problem if the use of or the authorization to disseminate the new work does not have a substantial adverse effect, financial or otherwise, on the exploitation or potential exploitation of the existing work or other subject matter or copy of it, or on an existing or potential market for it. In other words, if you are going to copy somebody else's work and create problems for the business of the original creator, you have a problem. So now, apply that to our case. Your law firm wants to use an AI to write articles in the style of fill-in-the-blank famous writer, right? You're not using their name because you're going to put your own name on it. In that sense, you're not using their name. But you are building it off of their work to generate something that you hope is going to bring you business. There may be a violation by the trainer of the AI. There may be a violation by you who are deploying the AI. What will halacha say? What will Jewish law say on this? Any guesses? Any thoughts?
To me, it brings to mind the greatest threat that AI poses, in my view, which is the inability of people to distinguish truth from falsehood.
So that's definitely a piece.
I think that's very true. I was going to ask, but we're going to get to that.
Rabbi, I meant to say, without knowing the answer, I meant to say that Jewish law is probably very strict on this issue.
Yes and no. So I'll tell you, because it's already 8:17, and we still have to see vignette number 4. Number 1, if the data used for the training was generated with a physical plant, it was generated with a computer, it was generated with a musical instrument, it was generated in a lab, then the creator is able to reserve the right to all discoveries made with their equipment. If you take a look at source number 3, Rabbi Yitzhak Alfasi, writing in the 11th century, was asked about a case in which there was a student who stole somebody else's notebook. The owner of the notebook demanded it back, and the thief said, "I'm not giving it back to you until first I copy it." So the question is he allowed to copy notes on Torah? Notes on Torah lectures. So the question is this person who stole it allowed to copy it? And Rabbi Yitzhak Alfasi said, absolutely not. You're not allowed to make use of somebody else's physical property for your ends, even though it's intellectual property. You're just copying the information. You're making a brand new copy, nonetheless, you're not allowed to do it. And he says, even though you're using it for a mitzvah, to learn Torah, it is absolutely not allowed. So number one, the owner of an item is allowed to reserve the rights and say, it's a physical item we're talking about now, I am not granting you access for the sake of doing X, Y, or Z. That's number one. Number two, if they compete with you, diluting the value of your intellectual property, Jewish law will not allow that either. If you take a look at source number 34 from Rabbi Yaakov Yeshaya Blau, running from the 11th century now up to the 21st, he wrote, it seems that every discovery or invention in a craft or form of work, like a patent, is subject to the rule against invading a boundary. Invading a boundary is a biblical law. You're not allowed to move the boundary markers on a property. This applies to inappropriate competition as well. And he argues that if you copy somebody else's patent, somebody else's discovery, somebody else's invention, then you're in violation. So that's a second issue, is competing by diluting the value of your intellectual property. Here's a third argument, which I'm contemplating. This came up in a class I gave, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago. If you're familiar with Kahlua, right, the liquor, it has a very distinctive label, this yellow label with this kind of orange-brown writing with a particular font. So some guy in Brooklyn produced a kosher version called Kafua. Label looks just the same, just switch an L for an F. And he produced it until he got sued, and then he was shut down. But the question is there a problem with doing that? And the argument goes that if somebody invests time, money, in producing something, and you demonstrate that you appreciate their investment by using it for yourself, then maybe you should be made to pay for their original investment in the product. It's based on a passage in the Talmud in Bava Basra, but I'm just going to show you an application of it in the 19th century in Poland. There was somebody who bought a government license to sell sweet, fragrant water. And under the terms of the license, he had a ticket, a printed ticket that he was able to put onto his product. Somebody else copied the printed license. So Rabbi Malkiel Tannenbaum in number 35 said, since he prints the etiquette in the tickets, like this person's tickets, we see that he is happy with the expenditure this person made in order to get the rights. And so he will be obligated to pay part of the money spent by the first party for the license. If you profit from somebody else's work by ripping it off, then you should have to pay for the work that they invested in producing it in the first place. That's another argument on the side of the creators, the original creators. Last argument is a policy argument. Rabbi Moshe Isserles dealt with what may be the most famous intellectual property case in Jewish law. This is 16th century Poland, as you can see. He had a second cousin. His second cousin was Rabbi Moshe of Padua in Italy. Rabbi Moshe of Padua wrote a commentary on Maimonides' work of law, the Mishneh Torah. And there was a publisher who ripped it off and sold a non-Jewish publisher. He sold a copy of Maimonides' work of law and included the commentary of Rabbi Moshe of Padua. The story is actually a little more complicated. It was Meir of Padua, sorry. But the story is a little more complicated because he also insulted Rabbi Meir of Padua in the publication. He said, "This is a terrible commentary. I'm only including it here because I want to show that this is complete and everybody can see just how bad the commentary is." So he dissed it and printed it at the same time. It was a whole saga. So anyway, Rabbi Meir of Padua appeals to Rabbi Moshe Isserles and asks him to ban purchase of this product. And Rabbi Isserles agrees. He says, "We will not abandon our part." In source 36, we declare that all Israel and anyone known as Israel should not purchase any new copy of Maimonides other than those which emerged from the hand of the aforementioned Gaon, Rabbi Meir of Padua himself, or those whom he has empowered, for the following four reasons. And one of his reasons is support of Torah scholarship. You shouldn't fund this publisher. You should be supporting the original scholar. And it's based on source number 37, which is a story from the Talmud regarding exactly that, the issue of support for a Torah scholar. So the argument goes that from a policy perspective, that's true. And maybe, you would apply that to protect creators whose work is valuable to us overall. Maybe. So you can make a lot of arguments, I think we've demonstrated, regarding intellectual property here. But Jewish law, yes. To go back to, I think it was Michael before, Jewish law is apt to be more strict in protecting the creators in this regard. I'm not going to take questions now because I want to make sure to at least spend the next 7 minutes on case number four. Case number four is the liability question. We go back to the Avianca Airlines case. The lawyer used the AI, had a very big problem as a result. Now what happens? I gave you a case in vignette number four where Pachim Ketanim LLP is using Kategor, a robot lawyer which can process and prosecute small claims autonomously. The technology has been in use for 5 years with very good reviews. But 5 months after it is introduced, Kategor makes a basic error in a client's case and the client sues Pachim Ketanim. Who is liable for the error made by Kategor? So if I had more time, I would walk you through it and do all the debates and so on, but I want to make this brief, especially because after the class I have to go to Mincha. So there's reason to argue that the lawyer is liable. The lawyer is a lawyer who did a bad job. It's a malpractice case. I brought you from that Lewis and Clark Law Review article in source number 38, but I won't read it inside. You can read it yourself, that either you view the AI as your tool, and in that case, you as a lawyer are responsible for the accuracy of the tools that you use, no different from any other tool that you used. If you used spreadsheet software and the spreadsheet had a bug, it would be on you. That's the way it goes. Or treat the AI like an employee, in which case you are responsible to supervise the work of your employees. In the event that you hire somebody, you know, whether it's an articling student or whether it's a paralegal, an intern, anybody who's working in a firm, ultimately the employer is responsible to make sure that that the work that's done is quality work. And so the argument would go, the lawyer's responsible for the problem that resulted. However, in our case, Kategor has been effective for 5 years with very good reviews. And therefore, the harm might be viewed as not foreseeable. You can make the argument that this wasn't foreseeable. I've been using this technology. The technology's been used all around the world. Unlike ChatGPT, everybody thinks it's fine. ChatGPT has on it a disclaimer that says it may tell you things that are wrong. That's not just like, you know, a disclaimer saying this is made in a factory where milk stuff was once made. Like, this is a real warning. Yes, the information is wrong on a regular basis. So the argument will go that in the ChatGPT case, this was foreseeable. In the vignette I gave you, it was not foreseeable. So this fellow, Michael Loy, who wrote the Lewis and Clark Law Review article, actually argues for an alternative. He said we should hold the AI liable for malpractice. What he wants to do is identify the robot lawyer as a legal entity with liability. And he goes into doing that in rem or in personam, but requiring registration for robot lawyers with insurance, some means of getting restitution when it makes a mistake, and consider it its own entity. I have a feeling that's actually the wave of the future. I think that that's where things are going to go. What about within Jewish law? So in Jewish law, we can do away with the idea of direct liability for the AI. There is no precedent in Jewish law for viewing a machine as its own legal entity. It's also not malpractice if you had every reason to think that it would function properly. We've seen in other classes a discussion about somebody who trains as a money changer, becomes an expert, and then makes a mistake, not because they were careless, but because occasionally a mistake will happen. And the rule is, if you trained in every way possible, you're going to be insulated from liability for malpractice. At worst, we would consider the AI or its employer what's called in Hebrew a mazik, somebody who harmed somebody else. But since your harm that you caused is indirect, it wasn't direct. You didn't hit somebody. There was a mistake that happened, and as a result, somebody else was harmed. So there may be, as I brought you in source number 39 from the Shulchan Aruch, from the Code of Jewish Law, there may be liability between you and God, but there's nothing actionable in court. This is what's called in Aramaic, grumma. It's indirect causation, and therefore you will not be liable. So I think that you're free from liability for this until there's new legislation on these issues. I would definitely suggest getting good insurance if you're going to use Kategor. You want insurance that's going to cover this sort of thing. But I think that that it's entirely possible to argue that that you'll be free from liability, assuming you used it in a competent way, and it wasn't and it had a good track record and so on, as opposed to what we saw in the beginning, where we talked about somebody who just used it in an irresponsible way. That's a different story. I apologize, but I have to run out in order to make mincha. Thank you very, very much. I'm going to send out a follow-up email, God willing, tomorrow. If you didn't sign in the chat yet, this is your last chance to do so in order to get credit. Being here, having your name on it is not sufficient. So last chance to send that to me. Thank you very, very much, everybody.